As we learned in our last study, Job's greatest concern is that, try as he might, he simply cannot find a way to get an audience with God. He insists that if he could just discover where God was and go to him, he'd be able to make a detailed case for his own innocence and respond in obedience to whatever he might command. Note again what Job said in verses 6 and 7 of the previous chapter. He asks, would he contend with me by the greatness of his power? In other words, would the Lord reject him out of hand simply because he was able to do that? And how does Job answer that? He says, no, surely he would pay attention to me. There the upright would reason with him, and I would be delivered forever from my judge. But again, Job's primary problem was that he simply couldn't find God. He didn't know where God might be, whether God might be hiding his face from him. At this point, Job has to be wondering if maybe his friends are correct, and maybe he has done something to offend God to the point where God is no longer even taking notice of him. He went on to say, behold, I go forward, but he's not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. When he acts on the left, I cannot behold him. He turns on the right, I cannot see him, but he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Here we find Job ultimately resigning himself to the fact that although he sought God in vain, although God was, for whatever reason, choosing to remain hidden from his perception, what was far more important to Job, and again, this is an instance of importance to Job and his ability to understand a little bit more about God than we might otherwise give him credit for, he took great pleasure in the fact that even though he couldn't perceive God, no matter how hard he looked or where he looked, he was comforted by the fact that God could see him, that God knows the way he takes, and he says, when he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. So Job's speech here is a little bit moderated compared to his previous speeches. Remember, Job has been known up to this point for being bordering on being disrespectful. Job has questioned God's goodness. He's questioned God's fairness. He's expressed himself in ways that are not exactly endearing himself to God. But here in the previous chapter, in chapter 24, Job seems to be moderating his response a little bit. And we might expect him to grow from this point forward, right? We might expect for this moderation in his approach to God to continue. But that's just not really the case. As I mentioned at the close of last time's message, Job seems to revert a little bit back to those previous ways of looking at God and God's dealings in his life. Now, in fact, there are many scholars who find what Job says here in this chapter so uncustomary and so out of place that some scholars have declared that this 24th chapter is actually an interpolation. What's an interpolation? Anybody know? What does it mean to interpolate? It basically means to take a text or a portion of a text from one location and move it to another location. In other words, it seems to a lot of scholars that what Job is doing, and I think this is really a scholarly attempt to explain away Job's regression, but there are a lot of scholars who say this is so out of character that it seems as if it's out of place. It seems like something has gone awry in the preservation of the text. Something has gone awry in how this has been recorded for us. It just doesn't square with what Job's trajectory has been up to this point. Now, you need to understand this. Interpolations don't insinuate error, not necessarily. It's just that sometimes the text of Scripture can be misplaced, if you will. Sometimes they can borrow from one place and put it in another place and so on and so forth. In this particular case, Again, some scholars believe that what was written here in chapter 24 is really too sharp a distinction from what he has just said in the previous chapter, so it's kind of out of context. So what's really going on here? Is this an interpolation? Is this a mistake in the preservation of the text? I don't think so. I think what we're seeing in Job is just simply another part of the human condition. I think what we're seeing in Job is a real regression in thought. I think we all have our ups and downs, do we not? We all have our way of understanding God and how He deals with us. And depending on our mood on any particular day or at any particular time during the day, we can fluctuate in terms of how we present God and how we understand what's actually going on in our lives. This kind of thing happens most often, I think, when we're attempting to make sense of the things that are particularly difficult for us to understand. In other words, I don't think Job is really as angry as it seems. I think he's just grasping at straws when it comes to understanding and articulating what he's going through. So what is it that Job says exactly that causes scholars to be concerned? Well, let's begin at verse 1. Job says, "Why are times not stored up by the Almighty, and why do those who know Him not see His days?" What does that even mean? Well, Job is actually asking why it is that God doesn't appoint set times for judging the wicked. And secondly, why those who know Him are not permitted to witness God's dealings with the wicked. Have you ever wondered that yourself? I'm sure you have. In fact, there are times when we can't make heads or tails about what's going on in the world, and we question how God deals with things and why He's not dealing with those things in a manner that we would find more pleasing. We always want to know why it is that God doesn't operate according to our timetable. We always want to know why it is that God withholds judgment in certain cases. In fact, Job has already explained to his friends that contrary to their opinion that God deals with the wicked very quickly, Job says, no, the wicked often prosper. The wicked often live long lives, and we can't explain why that is, but that's just the reality of the situation with God's not having this timetable that might please our own sense of justice or fairness. As one commentator noted, Job is questioning why a God who is all-powerful does not act in ways that align with human expectations of justice. Job is expressing a longing for a structured and predictable divine justice system. I think this is really just Job's way of behaving in the way that a lot of humans behave. We want God to be more like us. We take great comfort in this idea that God is like us, that instead of us being image bearers of God, God actually bears our image in some way. God routinely does all kinds of things that cause us to wonder or even question His rationale, timing, methods. Now, humanly speaking, I suppose it would be nice if He was more predictable, if His ways were more understandable among mere mortals, but that's simply not who He is. As He said through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, a passage familiar to most of you, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are my ways your ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." And Job and his friends obviously knew this, didn't they? In fact, Job's friend Zophar said something very similar back in Job 11. Go ahead and turn back there. Job 11, 7 through 10. Job 11, 7 through 10. When he asked Job, "Can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? They are as high as the heavens. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol, what can you know? Its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. If He passes by or shuts up or calls an assembly, who can restrain Him?" And of course the answer is no one. God is God. We are not. God has His ways of doing things, and we can't question those. We can question those, but He's not duty-bound to give us an answer to those things. So to answer Job's question here in our text, the reason God doesn't operate on a timetable that makes more sense to mortal men And the reason God doesn't permit mere mortal man to observe his direct dealings with the wicked is because he is who he is. He just is who he is. And who he is has nothing to do with satisfying the curiosity or meeting the felt needs of those who feel as though they're entitled to such things. God owes us no explanation for the things that he does, why he does them, when he does them, how he does them, simply because he is God. And not to beat a dead horse, but this is also an important key to contentment for believers. Knowing that we will never fully understand what God does and why he does it, and yet continuing to trust in him, despite the fact that we don't know everything there is to know about him or why he does what he does, this is actually one of the greatest sources to contentment that we can possess. Remember what faith is. How is faith defined? Faith is defined scripturally as the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. Faith is magnified to the extent that God remains mysterious to us and unknowable. It forces us to trust him. When we don't have the answers, we know that he does, even though he doesn't explain all those things to us, but that's a great source of contentment if we'll just avail ourselves of it. Anyway, going back to our text in verses 2 and following, Job gives some specific examples of the types of wicked individuals that he would love to see judged. First, he says, some remove the landmarks, they seize and devour flocks. Now, what does that mean? Well, in Job's day, and this was true in most places up until fairly recently, property lines were marked by boundary markers or sometimes boulders that were set in place so as to separate one person's land from another person's land. And it was very common among the wicked men to move these boundary markers. If I wanted to increase the size of my own property, all I had to do was take a boundary marker and move it from where it was farther onto someone else's land and then claim that it was that way all along. And then what would happen? Well, if there were any flocks that were on that part of the land, I would take those as well, arguing that those are now mine because they're on my land. You see how that worked. Job says this was quite common during the day, and this is the kind of wickedness that he would like to see God deal with. Of course, this kind of thing was highly illegal, but it happened. Look at Deuteronomy 27:17, and you can find this stated in a very clear law established among the Israelites. The law read very simply, "Cursed is the one who displaces his neighbor's boundary marker, and all the people shall say, Amen." Job goes on, it's not just people who move boundaries to their own advantage. He goes on to say that still others drive away the donkeys of the orphans. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. And again, this is really probably a more egregious crime because it involves the mistreatment of widows and orphans. We've talked before about how displeased God is with the mistreatment of widows and orphans, and yet there were some who would drive away the donkeys of the orphans and take away the widow's ox for a pledge. In many cases, the only real possession any of the extremely poor had was a beast of burden, whether that was a donkey or an ox, whatever the case might be. This is something that indicates the lowest of the low. This involves the taking of someone's beast of burden, someone's only prized possession, and depriving them of that thing. Job's like, I wish God would just deal with people who do that. Is it too much to ask that God would just judge them in the sight of all? Continuing at verse 4, Job adds to the list of crimes that the wicked engage in, and I'm just going to read all of this for the sake of time. It's very self-explanatory. He says, they push the needy aside from the road. The poor of the land are made to hide themselves altogether. Behold, as wild donkeys in the wilderness, they go forth seeking food in their activity. As bread for their children in the desert, they harvest their fodder in the field and glean the vineyard of the wicked. They spend the night naked without clothing and have no covering against the cold. They're wet with the mountain rains and hug the rock for want of a shelter. Others snatch the orphan from the breast, and again, against the poor, they take a pledge. They cause the poor to go about naked without clothing, and they take away the sheaves from the hungry. Within the walls, they produce oil. They tread wine presses, but thirst. From the city, men groan, and the souls of the wounded cry out. Job says all kinds of really bad things are going on all around us at all times. Job says, and I'm quoting from the New King James because it better captures what Job is actually saying here. Job concludes here, he says, God does not charge them with wrong. It seems as though they're doing these things and just continuing to get away with it. And I can share Job's frustration, can you? Look at what goes on by way of crime in this country. It's unabated. It's unaccounted for. Judges are not doing their jobs. Juries are not doing their jobs. The legal system is all but collapsed in many cases, and crime runs rampant. We should all wonder, what's going on? When will these people get their comeuppance? When will these people face their judge? When will these people be punished? Job wants the same thing to be answered by God himself. We see all these things going on, and yet it appears as though God's not charging them with wrong. Note once again that Job is obviously continuing to make the same point he made earlier against Zophar's argument that the reign of the wicked is short-lived. Job spent the whole of chapter 21 refuting that claim and pointing out that most of the time, as I said, wicked men do pretty well for themselves. And not only that, they live long, seemingly carefree lives in spite of their wicked deeds. It's as if Job's argument here has gone even a step further. He's saying not only do these wicked men thrive, not only do they prosper, not only do they live really long lives, it's as if God is not intent on doing anything to them. Ever. In verses 13 and following, Job continues. He says, others, which is simply his way of saying others within this same class of wicked people, others have been with those who rebel against the light. They do not want to know its ways nor abide in its paths. Now, we need to understand something about the light here. This is not a reference to gospel light or any kind of philosophical light. It's a reference to actual light, like daytime. It's the same type of thing that Jesus spoke about to Nicodemus in John 3:20 when he says that the evil man hates the light. It's like when you turn the light on and you have cockroaches in the middle of the night, right? They just run for the corners. Some of you are like, I've never experienced that. But most of us have. You know, you turn the light on and they scurry. Why? Because they can't stand the light. The evil man doesn't like the light because the light exposes his deeds. And so Job writes, the murderer arises at dawn. He kills the poor and the needy, and at night he's a thief. So wait a minute, though. If the wicked man rebels against the light, why does Job say that the murderer arises at dawn? Well, it helps to understand that by Jewish reckoning, the dawn is still nighttime. The dawn is late enough to where everyone is still asleep, and yet early enough for him to get up and do his thing without being caught. So again, it's kind of misleading according to our own reckoning, but according to Jewish reckoning, the dawn would still have been part of the night. This is also in keeping with Job's context as he continues. He says, the eye of the adulterer waits for the twilight, saying, no eye will see me. And he disguises his face. In the dark, they dig into houses. They shut themselves up by day. They do not know the light. For the morning is the same to him as thick darkness, for he is familiar with the terrors of thick darkness. They are insignificant on the surface of the water. Their portion is cursed on the earth. They do not turn toward the vineyards. Drought and heat consume the snow waters. So does Sheol, those who have sinned. A mother will forget him. The worm feeds sweetly till he is no longer remembered, and wickedness will be broken like a tree. He wrongs the barren woman and does no good for the widow. Now in verse 22, Job does admit that God eventually drags off such powerfully wicked men because no one has any assurance of life, but he also nonetheless provides them with security as he continues to watch their every move. Job concludes his speech in verses 24 and 25 with a bit of resignation to it all. He says, they are exalted a little while, then they are gone. Moreover, they are brought low, and like everything gathered up, even like the heads of grain, they are cut off. Now, if it is not so, who can prove me a liar and make my speech worthless? Now, if you're confused at this point about what Job's saying and how he's saying it, you're not alone. One of the most preeminent Job scholars was a man named Samuel Driver. And I want you to listen to his words with regard to verses 18 through 24. He described the Hebrew of verses 18 through 24 as, quote, difficult, ambiguous, and unintelligible. So if you're looking for a good scholarly explanation for what Job's actually saying here, even the brightest minds have trouble figuring it out. We've got to understand that a lot of this is written in prosaic form. A lot of this is in Hebraisms. A lot of this, you know, Job being one of the more ancient texts that we have in our Bibles, there is a great deal of disagreement, a great deal of misunderstanding, a great deal of confusion when it comes to what Job actually meant. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that we can't understand the overall meaning of the book of Job. And that's what we need to keep our sights focused on. The interpretation of this text that I've presented to you tonight is one of several possible ways of understanding what Job says. I've said at the very beginning of this study, Job is one of those books that if you go to 10 different commentators to ask them what Job's actually talking about here, you'll probably come out with 7 or 8 different understandings, because they're all in disagreement over finer points. We can know this, though, and we do know this. The book of Job is an account of one man's struggling for righteousness' sake, and God's attempt to explain how he works in a realm that is entirely his to work in. We're not really meant to understand all the finer points that are presented here. And I don't know about you, but I find great comfort in the fact that there is so much variation or shade of meaning in what is captured here in this book. And again, as Job's challenge in verse 25 indicates, whatever he's saying here, it's not just his opinion, but it's indisputable fact. And the same thing's been true in every generation before or since. No matter where we look, it seems as if the wicked continue to prosper, that crime continues to rage all around us, seemingly with no response or correction from God, at least not the immediate response that we would all prefer to see from him. You've actually heard the expression, crime never pays. Is that really true? In the short term, crime can pay really well. Now granted, in the ultimate, it doesn't pay. But this is Job's whole problem. When is the ultimate? You know, he does resign himself at the end saying, well, you know, at the end, yeah, they're all going to be drug away, and they all, you know, all, even the evilest men in the world die at some point. And then they meet their maker. But again, Job is kind of thinking out loud. He's wondering, why is it that God doesn't satisfy our innate curiosity and our innate desire for satisfaction and instead withholds those things from us? It's a legitimate question, but it's a question that I don't think Job really expected an answer to. We certainly know that he never got the answer to that because we ourselves don't have an answer to that. Why is it that God does what he does, when he does it, how he does it? We just don't know. We just don't know. And what does this have to do with Job's immediate circumstances? Well, remember, Job's friends are convinced that he's a wicked man, which is why he was being punished and suffering as horribly as he was. But if that was true, Job insists, it's more likely that God would simply allow him to continue in his wickedness unchecked, as he seemingly does with everyone else, as opposed to making him suffer the way he's suffering. He's actually using his argument as an explanation for why he's innocent. No, it can't be that I'm wicked, because look how God deals with the wicked. He allows them to prosper. He allows them to live long lives. That's not me. I'm suffering unimaginably, and no one knows why. Not even me. Job is simply attempting yet again to prove his innocence. Well, in the next chapter, we find Bildad speaking up again in a very brief speech. It's a beneficial speech because he has a lot of good things to say, a lot of good observations to make, but it has little to nothing to do with anything concerning Job himself. In fact, in the following chapter, chapter 26, Job's going to tell him as much. It's as if Bildad, just wanting to fill the empty space, starts saying things in chapter 25 and in chapter 26. If you'll go and look over there, Job's like, what was that? What are you even talking about? Lord willing, we're going to look at both of those chapters in our next time together.